it's a word that gets thrown around a lot. And if something gets thrown around a lot, it means everything and nothing.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 13 of Damn the Absolute. There has long been a bit of jousting between the human and natural sciences over who is more rigorous or which method is better capable of providing us with facts about the world. For certain types of empiricists, this jockeying for epistemological status and justification has tended to skew in favor of the natural sciences. And given the premium some cultures place on prediction, control, and the power that comes with laying hold of causal laws, the natural sciences have enjoyed abundant prestige over the past two centuries. In hopes of garnering a similar reputation, some of the human sciences have made significant efforts to modify their methods to more closely resemble those used in the natural sciences. But can we study human experience in the same way we tend to examine the natural world? Just as there are reliable causal laws that can be generalized across the globe, are there moral or social laws that dictate the dynamics of human history? In the 19th century, the German philosopher Wilhelm Dilthey attempted to make a clear distinction between the methods used by the natural sciences and those employed by the human sciences. Whereas the natural sciences are looking for generalizable laws or supposed regularities about the physical world, he proposes that the human sciences ought to focus on understanding and interpreting lived experience. Lived experience contrasts with abstract or theoretical representations of experience, which are more like idealized forms of what it means to be human, largely divorced from the flesh and blood of history. Lived experience, on the other hand, requires that we interpret and continually reinterpret what it means to be human from a given point in history. This is based on what individuals communicate about what it feels like to be them. This is sometimes also applied to questions pertaining to racial identity, gender dynamics, economic background, and the various ways in which people experience life differently from one another. Henrike Hanula is a doctoral candidate at the University of Vienna in Austria. Originally from Finland, her research focuses on late 19th century German philosophy, specifically that of Wilhelm Dilthey. She explains the central role the concepts of historicism, lived experience, and hermeneutics play in Dilthey's philosophy. And what could also be considered a rallying cry for the human sciences, Hanula argues for a rigorous and systematic approach to studying culture and society that is informed by the work of Wilhelm Dilthey. Now, what reasons do we have to think human experiences and the natural world should be studied differently? Why might it be more productive to study the human condition at the nexus of lived experience rather than through an abstract or detached framework? And if gaining a meaningful understanding of culture requires that we continually have to reinterpret human interactions and events, how can we ever arrive at any certain knowledge in the human sciences? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Henrike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
At Damn the Absolute, we like to do our best trying to practice some intellectual humility. What is a viewpoint you've held as an adult you were confident would never change that has actually shifted dramatically?
Yeah, intellectual humility is a bit, now it's a bit embarrassing to say that I don't think that I've had radical changes in my political or philosophical opinions that I seem to have been formed quite early. I mean, I have learned things and shifted positions in different, but the core of my opinions has always been quite the same. But yeah, I guess one thing is that when I started being into philosophy, like in high school and so on, I was very into sort of, well, Heidegger and French existentialists, and I guess continental philosophy in general. And now I'm just more of a, I don't know, more like a in this Wittgensteinian sense that whereof one cannot speak, thereof must one must be silent.
You spent a lot of time in continental philosophy, Henrika, and today we're going to be discussing the philosopher Wilhelm Dilthey. Dilthey's father and grandfather were both Calvinist ministers, and he even intended to become a pastor in the Reformed Church himself. What impact do you think this background had on his approach to philosophy?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I don't think there is a straightforward answer. In a letter, this is something that is always quoted. In a letter to his mom, he sometime in his 20s said that he has lost his religion and he has never been naturally religious. And also his philosophy is very much defined by sort of anti-metaphysical attitude. He's very sort of adamantly anti-metaphysical. And I don't think he ever had a spiritual crisis. It's just really just he thought that religion is not a relevant thing anymore, especially because of historical relativity of every kind of religious system. He just saw that there is just not a very good chance that any particular religious dogma would be correct. However, he also wrote a lot about Friedrich Schleiermacher, who was a philosopher and theologian in German Romanticism, and who had this kind of pietist idea of religion as this inner feeling or sort of immediate religious experience. And in a Dilthey's later text, which is, I think, called The Problem of Religion, if I remember correctly, he also kind of admits that this sort of religious experience, or sort of mode of experiencing, could have some sort of a kind of independent credibility, even though it's not rational. I don't know, maybe that's not the kind of the most interesting thing about Dilthey and Schleiermacher's relationship. It's rather that this kind of inner feeling and inner experience that Schleiermacher was talking about then kind of transferred into Dilthey's own kind of philosophy and epistemology, although of course then it didn't have this sort of metaphysical and religious connotations that it has in Schleiermacher. So yeah, his systematic philosophy is kind of atheist and agnostic, at least agnostic, but it still is very kind of tied and sort of related to this kind of longer tradition of German theology.
Dilthey, like many thinkers at the time, as you mentioned, saw science as replacing religion as a source of a lot of cultural values and maybe even morality. He seemed to be trying to reposition philosophy in the place of religion in some sense. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think it would be fair. Or worldview, I think, rather, because philosophy for him would be more of this sort of, it would be not be for every man to do philosophy, but kind of philosophy could still kind of uncover the traditions and values that kind of everybody could sort of subscribe to.
So for Dilthey, is philosophy for everyone, or are you suggesting that for him philosophy was reserved for a specific type of person?
Yeah, or rather philosophy is what philosophers do. I think that's kind of the idea. That it's not a lifestyle, it's still it's in a Kantian sense, it's a critique. It's something like a systematic critique and not sort of a worldview in itself.
If I'm sitting in a room with Dilthey, what credentials or what do I need to present to him to have him say, okay, yes, you are a philosopher, you do philosophy?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Dilthey is I think that he would be much more impressed if you would just talk about history with him and show how well you know history and how the world is and sort of the structures of human experience in history. And this is the thing, a tricky thing about Dilthey, that I think for him, history and philosophy are so inextricably intertwined that it's very difficult to see what is actually philosophy and what is history and so on.
Dilthey, he viewed, I understand, philosophy and history as being mutually corrective of one another. What did he believe the historian's task was as compared to the philosopher's task?
Yeah, this is a great question, and I really like it because this is actually what I wrote my master thesis on. And my argument there was that for him, there was both his kind of intellectual identity as a historian and as a philosopher were equally important. And all philosophical thinking is historical, and all historical thinking, if it's done correctly, is philosophical. And because they both try to uncover what it is to be human and the kind of the human experience in this sort of very strong sense. But there is still a difference in the sense that a historian studies the past as it actually was empirically, and a philosopher tries to kind of systematically make sense of this study of past.
For Dilthey, history is so central to how he approaches philosophy, and there's an approach he takes in philosophy that is known as historicism. What is the best way to understand historicism and how it connects to his overall approach to philosophy?
So historicism is one of those concepts that is really difficult to define. But in the most basic sense, it means that we take ideas and things to be historically constituted in some important sense. It might differ in what sense and to what extent they are historically constituted. But generally, it is against the idea of a fixed human nature, for example. And in the 19th century, especially in Germany, it was against Hegelianism and these sort of idealist conceptions of history, that there is a direction to history. I mean, I'm sure that there is some Hegelian now who screams that that's not what Hegel says, but that's what Dilthey took him to say. And also historicism was in opposition to naturalism, which would then say that the humanity is, we can understand or explain what it is to be human by referring to law-like laws of nature or law-like regularities. So yeah, historicism also implies a certain sort of historical relativism.
Let me pitch this back to you, see if I'm hearing this correctly. Someone who's not a historicist would look at history and human nature and would say, what it means to be human is these four or five things, whatever characteristics someone wants to list off. Maybe someone says it's human nature is to be self-interested, and that is taken as kind of a natural law or a universal and permanent notion. Whereas someone who's a historicist will take an alternative view and say human nature can be understood in a very specific context of a place in a history, and it's not so much of something that is inherent in humanity but manifests in a specific place. Is that track?
Yeah, that would be like that there are kind of infinitely many ways of being a human. And this was really not only Dilthey who thought about it, thought like this. It's, I think, Herder would be the first one from German, like Romanticism and so on. The sort of plurality of the ways of being human as it kind of appears in history was the aesthetic way of looking at history.
Yeah, this notion of historicism, I think some listeners were already heading down this road, but you can see how this manifests in big cultural differences and how people talk about social and cultural issues, for example, around notions of gender or race, and how maybe a non-historicist would say gender is this way and these are these unchanging notions that what it means to be male or female, etc.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, Dilthey as a 19th century dude wasn't very well interested in gender, but yeah, basically that would be sort of metaphysics of gender would, I think, be a very anti-historicist idea that there are some sort of fixed gender roles, for example.
Piggybacking off of some of the more relevant notions of culture, Dilthey is a proponent of the notion of lived experience, and it plays pretty centrally to his philosophy. What exactly does he mean by the notion of lived experience?
Yeah, this is a bit tricky, but I'll try to make sense of it. There is this kind of a nice singer by Dilthey where he describes the philosophical subject of Locke and Hume and so on. It's like no real blood flows in the veins of the subject constructed by Locke, Hume, and Kant, but rather the diluted extract of reason as a mere intellectual activity. And for him, the subject of philosophy should, and kind of epistemic subject, should be something else. Not only like thinking, rational being, but also feeling and willing being, so volitional being. And this is kind of the structure of experience and structure of being in the world, that you don't only like want to know things and comprehend things, you also relate to it through volitions and emotions. And this is kind of the lived experience that is the very basic structure of experience.
So if I were to try and make sense of, let's say I have a friend or an acquaintance, if I'm trying to make sense of their psychology, how might I make sense of them in the more abstract notion that you talked about versus how might someone like Dilthey understand them through the notion of lived experience?
Yeah, I think that lived experience for Dilthey is very much an analytic concept. It's just an extension of Kantian subject in a way. So if you think about how it is used today, it's not the same. It's for Dilthey, it's much more connected to his epistemology of the human sciences. The kind of this lived experience is just the epistemological foundation of the human sciences. And if you want to understand, I mean, you have lived experience because you are a human being, you are a volitional being who lives in the world and you have kind of the same structure of experience. And if you want to experience, understand somebody who is close to you, you kind of see them as relevantly similar beings. Even though they're, of course, the things that they want or the things that they fear might be different, you can still understand them because you have this sort of basic level similarity of lived experience. It's still like very sort of analytic concept, I think, for Dilthey.
If I were to embrace this notion of lived experience, does that suggest that I can't ever quite know what it's like to be this other person, but I can still get close to it? Or might embracing this notion of lived experience mean that I can have a good sense of what it means to be? For example, can I have a sense of what it means to be or feel like being Henrike Hannula?
Yeah, it's a good question, because in this whole thing comes very much from Schleiermacher, and Schleiermacher's conception of this feeling and of this lived experience is very romantic, and it's based on this sort of individuality that is ineffable, and it is sort of, you can never understand how it is to be another person, but you can always try, and the only way is to kind of through sympathy. But for Dilthey, I think that's not the problem. I mean, he is not interested in exactly knowing how it is to be somebody else. It is much more about, it's like Dilthey's lived experience is not this sort of subjectivistic, mystical thing, but it is more like just a basic level of experience that makes it possible for us to understand each other on some level. And kind of the understanding then is constituted by me talking to you and me, I'm telling you who I am and what I'm doing and so on. And that's how you kind of interpret how it is to be me. It's not sort of through my lived experience. It's just that we both kind of share the same world in which things make sense. And that's kind of the basis of understanding between people.
As I'm understanding, lived experience seems to put a bit more of an emphasis on, rather than me focusing on my own notion of who you are and what your experience is in this more detached way, it's focusing on how you express what your experience is and how you orient in the world.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's why it's important to remember that it's really has more to do with Dilthey's idea of the human sciences or social sciences, that it is kind of the methodological basis for that. So it's not in this sense about understanding other people in general. It's just more of a pragmatic methodological notion that we understand each other because we talk or we kind of express ourselves. And that's the only thing that I can access from your lived experience, the ways that you kind of put it in the words, or I don't know, if you would do art, then, you know, I could try to access your lived experience through your works of art. The lived experience itself, it's personal, sort of subjective thing. But there is nothing mystical about it. It's not like that we're just floating in our private experiences.
Lived experience is a term that's thrown around a lot in conversations online and in person in what is considered the culture wars. In what ways do you see the term lived experience being abused or misunderstood contemporarily?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing if it's misunderstood, because I'm not sure to what extent one could say that it's from Dilthey, but Dilthey's lived experience clearly doesn't have much political relevance. And also he was, a 19th century quite conservative dude. So of course, he wasn't that interested in the lived experiences of minorities or women. Or I mean, for him, basically lived experience might change or be kind of variable between cultures and historical eras. But basically, it is always a white man who is the experience, the one who experiences the historical eras and so on. I think, though, that in like contemporary feminist epistemology or kind of discussions about hermeneutic injustice or standpoint epistemology, those actually develop the notion of lived experience quite in fruitful and interesting ways forward and rethink it. And I think those could actually be very sort of fruitful in this sort of culture war or just political discourse. So yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. But yeah, it's a word that gets thrown around a lot. And if something gets thrown around a lot, it means everything and nothing.
I'd like to go a little bit further down this row of what lived experience could be. You mentioned having fruitful discourse in talking about it right now. What are some of the ways in which you think lived experience can be applied socially or politically today. And this Diltai may not, as you mentioned, may not go this way, but what were some ways that you would like to utilize the notion of lived experience?
If we take the lived experience as something that knowledge and morality and all this, at least, especially like in epistemic sense, that knowledge is some in some sense situated culturally or historically or also like in terms of gender or race or a class or so on, then I think it's just important to keep in mind that people's lived experiences are different. So just sort of basic intersectionality is, I think, lived experience can be very much in heart of that discussion.
You also mentioned hermeneutics, which is very central to Diltai's philosophy. For someone who's less familiar with the term, what is hermeneutics and how does it connect with the rest of his work?
Hermeneutics basically can be defined as the art or science or philosophy of interpretation. So originally it came from biblical studies or sort of religious studies in the 18th century. It was about interpreting religious texts. But especially Schleiermacher was in the forefront of making it a bit like a broader notion of interpreting language in general. So, and written culture especially. And Diltai then made it into, or saw that it could work as a kind of method of the human sciences. So the process of understanding in hermeneutics is basically, there's this basic idea that individual and the context kind of reflect each other. Or you can't understand one without the other. So basically, so there's this process of hermeneutic understanding is called quite famously hermeneutic circle. This is one of the first things that you would learn. So one's understanding of, say, text as a whole or written is established by reference to the individual parts of it. And then one's understanding of each individual part is established by reference to the whole. And in history, the science or like history as a subject, this would work like that understanding one person, an individual person, say Napoleon or, I don't know, Diltai, for me, very relevant. So understanding them helps understand their time better. But at the same time, understanding their time better, understanding what was going on at the time, helps me understand the individual better. So this is kind of, then you go to this circle where kind of you deepen knowledge of both the individual and of the context. And this is how you kind of reach understanding, but it's also kind of a never-ending circle or kind of a spiral that you just go deeper and deeper.
Hermeneutics, as you mentioned, is typically very connected to interpreting and reinterpreting texts based in scripture, philosophy, literature, you name it. In what ways might someone listening be able to take hermeneutics and apply it to, let's say, contemporary film, maybe a big blockbuster movie? Could someone use hermeneutics to better benefit from seeing, say, a Marvel movie?
Well, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's especially, I think, for art and even if you don't want to say that it's art, Marvel movies, you would watch the film, but you never watch it outside of its context. You know that it's part of the whole Marvel cinematic universe. You then also probably, if you are socially aware of enough, you know about the structures. I mean, I think Marvel is Disney, right? No? Mm-hmm. So you kind of know about the whole Disney thing and then you kind of just put it in that context. I mean, you might also not care. I mean, maybe you don't care what Marvel movies kind of represent, but if you are interested enough, you might also see the kind of the social messages that it tries to push forward. I mean, I haven't really seen Marvel movies, I think, so I can't really make a hermeneutic analysis, but you get the point that you kind of widen the interpretative loop when you try to understand it.
I think maybe another way of understanding hermeneutics would be to view there is no document, medium, or piece of art that is static and unchanging and in its sort of completed form, that everything is a living document, essentially.
Yeah, that would be, I think, a very sort of in later hermeneutics, that's very important. But I'm not sure if that's so much what Diltai would be looking. That would be a Gadamerian sort of hermeneutics, that interpretation is always this living thing and understanding is fusion of horizons of the original and the interpreter. But for Diltai, I think it is really about getting as close as possible to the original meaning. So if you try to understand the poem that was written in the 19th century, there's like an intended meaning that you want to get at. And then the interpretation tries to get to that sort of objective meaning, even if it's not, you can never get to it fully by contextualizing that poem, you kind of try to understand it better. But this is, of course, why hermeneutics is very much sort of, it works for historical sciences, because then it's about the contextual understanding. And maybe in art, you don't want to always be married to this idea that every artwork is just a reflection of their time.
In the back of my mind, I have this thought as I'm asking you this question. In American politics, the views around the Constitution, and maybe in Germany and other European countries, there are similar notions of constitutions, of it being the originalist perspective, or when it comes to scripture, that there's an original intent that either authors or maybe God had intended. And people can apply, someone like Diltai might apply trying to get the closest to that original intent, even though they may not, we may never quite get that, they're getting closer to it. Whereas, is it correct to view that more contemporary or later hermeneutics are less interested in what could be called original intent, or more focused on here is a medium we can look at and we're going to use it to continually try and reapply and find new meaning?
Yeah. I would say that's a good way to sort of put it. Although in Diltai's defense, I don't think he would have been an originalist in law. I think he thinks that law is something that always changes. But the interpretation of the original document would still try to get at the original meaning.
So I've already brought up, I'm trying to bring this a little bit into some American audiences. A lot of Americans and English speakers aren't familiar with Diltai. The pragmatist philosopher William James and Diltai were contemporaries, and they actually even met while William James was visiting and studying in Berlin. And I have a quote from James. He wrote, in reference to Diltai, said, "He is the first man I have ever met of a class, which must be common here, of men to whom learning has become as natural as breathing." So very high praise. And there are a lot of philosophical connections. What are some of the ways in which William James and Diltai connect to one another?
Yeah, it's a great, the letter is really funny. I mean, he also, I think, says something like that Diltai is wearing a dusty old rag of a cravat, and also he tells how Diltai just fell asleep with a napkin on his head, like after dinner. But yeah, so the Diltai-James connection, I think it's very interesting. There is definitely connection. There is a lot to be discovered there. And it has not yet been studied that much. I mean, there is one German sociologist, I think he only mostly writes in German, Matthias Jung, who has made that connection very explicitly. I mean, I guess it kind of depends how foundationalist you take Diltai to be, because with what we said about the lived experience, I was trying to make the point that it was the foundation, it was meant to be the epistemological foundation of the human sciences. And that would not be a very pragmatist sort of thing to do, because it's still like a very sort of Kantian idea that you just want to have this very firm foundation that you can build everything on. But later he also expresses the idea of how individuality is ineffable, and there are so many, like infinitely many ways that life can converge, and individuals and cultures and so on, and how the finitude of the human mind will never be kind of up to the task of understanding the totality of life. And the best we can do is this sort of heuristic analysis of life. And that there, I think, is a very clear kind of similarity to pragmatism. And I would say also hermeneutics is very pragmatic. In this Diltaian sense, at least in the 19th century sense, hermeneutics is, I think, a very sort of pragmatic attitude. And also what Matthias Jung says is that for Diltai, this lived experience itself can be seen in a pragmatist sense, that an individual existence is this sort of subject's adaptation to the surroundings. So this kind of life generally, or historical life, is this field of interactions between individuals and their surroundings. So that would also be a pragmatist notion. And also, Diltai once mentions James and likes the varieties of religious experience very much. Thinks it is a great piece of philosophy.
Yeah, it's a fantastic piece. I'm actually conducting a reading group right now, and we are reading through the varieties. So I will echo and give two thumbs up on that with Diltai. You mentioned one distinction between Diltai's philosophy and maybe someone like William James is that he might be a little bit more foundationalist. And this is very important in his work, as he's trying to make a distinction between how we do human sciences or social sciences versus the natural sciences. Could you speak a little bit more about how he distinguishes between how we do the two differently?
I guess now it would be helpful to say that when Diltai talks about what I call the human sciences, he talks about Geisteswissenschaften, which German word that in English would be like sciences of the spirit. That just sounds a bit too spooky, I think, in English. But that would basically just be both the social sciences and humanities. So every kind of field of inquiry that has to do with the human world or the cultural and social world, and every field of claim systematic inquiry. Yeah, so that would be the human sciences. That's what the way I'm using it. It's not a perfect translation, but it's, I think, the best we have. The distinction between the human and the natural sciences boils down to this kind of famous explanation versus understanding distinction. And the formulation is something like, we explain the nature and understand the life of the soul. And there we go back to the lived experience, because through this lived experience, we have a direct access to this human world and this sort of nexus of the social cultural facts. So we are kind of insiders in it. Well, when we look at nature, we are not kind of in the same way insiders. You could make, I think, a connection to phenomenology later, like later phenomenology and kind of Lebensfeld or life world of Husserl, that it's something like, it's kind of a cognitive difference and phenomenal difference that we have to the human sciences and the natural sciences. Another difference is that Diltai takes that the natural sciences are always interested in natural laws, the subsumption theory of knowledge, that you always want to explain everything through causality and causal laws. While human sciences, he's always interested in historical explanation, mostly, is about individual occurrences. If a billiard ball hits another, then you explain it through causality. But when there is a war, like a particular war only breaks out once, and then you need a different kind of way of understanding that. Of course, there were people who disagreed, and there were sociologists particularly who thought that you can kind of find laws, social laws, for example.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. So if I understand correctly, Diltai might say the natural sciences tend toward trying to find, or are maybe able to find, generalizable laws that are a little bit more out there, whereas in the human sciences, we're a bit more inside of it. And there's a quote from Diltai where he says, the certainty of our knowledge rests in us ourselves. And as we move away from ourselves, our knowledge becomes gradually less certain. That, I think, really captures that. Does that track?
Yeah, the human world and everything that it kind of represents. And especially it's easier for me to understand the meanings and the significances of my own sort of immediate surroundings. If I go to Finland, where I'm from, I'm going to understand things better than I understand them in a very different culture. But then if I go further in history, it's even more difficult. But then there is this thing that these are still somehow all connected in this sort of shared humanity, shared sort of lived experience thing. But when I try to understand why a tree is growing, then I can't kind of apply these ideas of intentionality or significance that I can apply when I try to understand the work of art, for example.
So if I were Diltai trying to do some political analysis right now, I presume then he would be much more comfortable with me doing some analysis of my local community or maybe my city as compared to me trying to do some political analysis of what is happening around the United States or trying to make a grand sweeping claim about American politics. Would that be fair?
I think he would be fine with it. You would just have to learn a lot. You would have to really immerse yourself in the actual sources. This is why I think it's important to emphasize that this sort of lived experience and even this immediate kind of experience, it's not something mystical that prevents me from understanding. But it is just like, of course, if you want to understand something that is not familiar to you, you just have to kind of study it a lot. This is the, I think, very pragmatic and practical thing that gets lost kind of in later hermeneutics from Heidegger and Gadamer. So he has this very sort of strong emphasis on empirical historiography in a way. And you could apply it to kind of political analysis too. So if you have enough sources, you can always interpret them.
Diltai believe that ethics poses a series of dilemmas for us that we have no satisfactory resolution for. Basically, morality is very historical. What exactly is Diltai's approach to morality and ethics?
Good thing I just read his ethics. He didn't write that much about ethics, but he had a lecture course in 1890s. So basically, he indeed said that ethics and morality is historically contingent. I mean, that kind of follows from his historicism. But he has a very, I think, interesting sort of, now we would say, social constructivist or even kind of evolutionary account about how morality develops. But what is important for him that we cannot kind of have any a priori kind of ideas about morality. It's only if we are going to build or understand how ethics works or build a, like an ethic, like system of ethics, it can only happen through anthropological analysis and sort of, again, hermeneutic understanding. But it is also based on inner experience in the sense that we have this sort of commonality. We are all human beings. We all share the same structure of experience. And that kind of gives us this sort of basic level of sympathy that can then be the foundation of morality. It's not a feeling like in Hume. It's not that we just are empathetic beings, but it is like a basic level thing that I see that you are like me enough that I kind of recognize you as a ethically important kind of a being.
So for Diltai, I couldn't enter a situation with an a priori notion of morality that I can be certain is going to fit the situation. Is that fair?
I would say that it's when you find yourself in a certain cultural and historical setting, then your morality is fixed for you already. It's not relative in the sense that you can just somehow choose not to act according to the moral standards of your time and place. But it is relative in the sense that there are no meta level things keeping it. So it's more of a meta ethical position. But I think in kind of first order ethics, you just kind of you're stuck with your time and place and the moral norms that it gives you. And funnily enough, he kind of also thinks that through this natural progression of morality, we just like somehow end up with categorical imperative. So that's kind of the natural end of morality is Kantian ethics, which is quite, I think, delightful.
So I'm wondering if I'm looking at how to evaluate historical figures, which there's a lot of discussion right now and always has been, but there's a lot of discussion as to what we are supposed to do with historical figures who have a mixed legacy, whether that's because of their racist ideologies or maybe some problematic politics. How might Diltai take someone, say, some of the founding fathers of the United States, like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, who, and feel free to include any historical figure you would like to, but who have been celebrated and mythologized in the United States and yet have some very troubling aspects to their legacy. How might Diltai approach them and evaluate them?
That's interesting. An interesting question. But I think his basic attitude is historicist attitude. And his kind of ethical stance as a historian, Diltai was also a historian, not only a philosopher, is that you have to sort of be objective and not judge people. You just have to kind of see their significance, but you can't pass moral judgment on people who lived in the past. And that's not what writing history is about. But then again, he was a 19th century conservative upper middle class dude. So, I mean, it's important to remember where he was coming from. Yeah, living in imperialist Germany. So, you know.
So, Henrike, Diltai was writing more than a century ago. What do you consider to be the greatest relevance of his works today, especially in the social sciences?
I would make a kind of a political point, I guess, because the part and it's also philosophical. So kind of the part and parcel of his philosophy is this difference between natural and human sciences or social natural and human sciences and human and social sciences, I mean. And the point is that these two are two different enterprises with their own like methods and with their own epistemological foundation and so on, but they are both equally rigorous and equally systematic and equally sort of scientific. There is this whole discussion about how social sciences and how humanities are like soft and how there is a crisis of the humanities and so on. And I feel like often people who defend the social sciences that say that they are good and exact because they are like the natural sciences and kind of take their methods from them. And often the people who say that humanities should get funding go to, I think, back to this sort of very, well, I'm sorry, but kind of old-fashioned idea about reading great books makes you more sympathetic or sort of a better person, or reading history cultivates your personality. But I would like to take Dilda and say that this is not what the, I mean, it's all great. I mean, read books and become more sympathetic. Sure. I mean, that's great. But what the human sciences should be about is this sort of rigorous and systematic kind of analysis of what it is to be human and what culture is and what society is. And there is nothing soft about it and nothing easy about it. So human sciences are important and difficult and they need funding.
So Diltai, he's written a lot. He has over 20 volumes of philosophy. Unfortunately, for those of us who are English speakers only and can't read the German, we don't have access to most of this, but some of it is starting to be translated. I think roughly 6 or 7 volumes have been translated so far. With more of those being translated in English, do you expect there to be some type of revival of Diltai's thought? Maybe that's a little strong.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's what my future like career development hinges on. So yeah, hopefully. No, but generally, I would also hope that and wish that the late 19th century German philosophy would get a bit more attention, because it's full of interesting figures and positions that are neglected and still feel very fresh, because it was exactly at the time when special sciences were institutionalized. And so there is a lot of very fruitful sort of interactions between sciences and philosophy and psychology and sort of very exciting stuff that is not at all obvious now. And it's very sort of treasure, like a rich treasure trove for philosophical insights. So yeah, I hope for a revival.
For those who are waiting for those English translations to come out, who are some other thinkers, especially more contemporary thinkers, that are working in a similar space as Diltai?
Honestly, I'm so married to my dissertation right now that I'm mostly working in reading 19th century people. But I think the explanation versus understanding thing is still a very fresh and much discussed topic in the philosophy of social sciences or philosophy of the human sciences. So there you could find people who are doing it. And hermeneutics generally is doing well. It's a subfield of philosophy, maybe not like the most popular, but there is very interesting stuff there.
Diltai was known for his voracious mind, constantly inhaling, exhaling ideas. He seems to have a lot of admirable traits. What do you find most admirable about Wilhelm?
Yeah, that's basically it. He was so interested in the world, in the human world, as he say. He says, I don't remember the quote now, but it's like, when he turned 70 and he had a big speech at the University of Berlin, the first thing that he said that he's so thankful that he got to spend his life doing what he most loves, which is pondering the life of the human world or human mind or so on. And I just find that very nice. And I don't know, I decided that I want to be a historian when I was 12. And I've never really, I mean, I'm doing history of philosophy and philosophy of history, but it's still close enough. So, I mean, that's something that I just like, it gets me. Deep level. I also just want to study history. That's nice.
Henrika, you are in the middle of your dissertation. For those of us who are eagerly awaiting to read your dissertation or other work, how far along in the process are you? When are you expecting to finish your PhD?
Probably going to take a couple of years. Let's see. 2 years, maybe then. It's going to be in English, so that's fine.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to reading that. I appreciate you coming on the show and teaching us a little bit more about a thinker who's less familiar to English speakers. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.